We welcome Professor Lewis W. Spitz, one of the foremost scholars among us in the area of Renaissance and Reformation studies. Let me say a few words of introduction regarding Professor Spitz. He is, I believe, a native of Nebraska, if memory serves me right from last evening, and holds degrees from the University of Missouri, Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, and Harvard University, where he took his PhD. Among his books in progress, Dr. Spitz lists one titled The Reformation in Historical Thought, Five Centuries of Interpretation, a volume I think clearly intended to be a parallel to a famous book, well-known book by Wallace K. Ferguson, entitled The Renaissance in Historical Thought. And this is certainly a desideratum of contemporary Reformation scholarship. It is out of this current research, as well as his previous work, that Professor Spitz will address us on the topic Images of Luther. Professor Lewis Spitz.
Well, that great American wit Herbert Hoover once received a wonderful introduction like that. And he said it reminded him of a bottle of cologne. Smells good, but it says right on the label not to be taken internally. On this 500th anniversary, and I suppose we're probably all anniversaried out, my sister calls this the essential quincentennial. And the Munich paper published a wonderful cartoon which showed Goethe on a cloud, and below on another cloud Richard Wagner and Karl Marx and Martin Luther. They forgot Mussolini, who was born 100 years ago also. Everybody seems to be forgetting him. And are trying to. And Goethe is saying, cheer up, boys. Jubilee years pass by, too. On this 500th anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther, the world pauses, and we are gathered here to take note of his person and his impact on the course of modern history. Luther, whom Carlyle called a Wundermann of religion, was indeed a great man of history, according to Jakob Burckhardt's definition of a great man, as one without whom history would have been substantially different than it was. In no nation or age has a more commanding and powerful writer appeared, declared Leopold von Ranke, and it would be difficult to find another who has so perfectly united popular and intelligent style and such downright good sense to so much originality, power, and genius. Luther has always been acknowledged to be one of the pivotal personalities of history, universal in appeal. We cannot fully appreciate all that we owe to Luther in the Reformation, Goethe exclaimed. We have been freed from the shackles of spiritual narrow-mindedness. We have become capable, as a result of our developed culture, to return to the fountain and to grasp Christianity in its purity. We possess once again the courage to stand with sure feet upon the earth and to feel ourselves in our divinely endowed human nature. Luther is one of those people who grow in stature the better one gets to know them. Hans Preuss once observed that in the fog, objects and persons appear to be greater than they are. This is often the case with great men of history who appear before us in outsized proportions if we do not see them clearly. of lesser stature when we really know them. But in Luther's case, the exact opposite is true. He grows in greatness the better one knows him. His importance for modern history increases, not in a Nietzschean sense of monumental history, but because we become increasingly aware of his importance for us in today's world. In those memorable words of Pericles, "The whole earth is a sepulcher of famous men, and their story is graven not only on stone over their native earth, but lives on far away, without visible symbol, woven into the stuff of other men's lives." Toward the close of his life, Luther told his class, "After my death, many will adduce my books and will prove from them confirmabunt all sorts of errors and their own imaginings, deliria." How right he was. Lord Byron once referred to people who have just enough learning to misquote. "They are trying to make me into a fixed star," Luther complained, "but I am an irregular planet." In one way, Luther was the most accessible figure of his century, for he was an open personality who wore his heart on his sleeve. He was a prolific writer. He had the center of the stage, and he was surrounded by a staff of reporters. In another way, he has been difficult to understand, for he was a man in motion, one who loved to give self-contradictionists something upon which to exercise their misguided ingenuity. He was a religious genius, a radical, and a very consequential thinker, like the church fathers, who, as Robert of Melun in the 12th century observed, did not propose things that were not opposed. Sacri patris quod non oppugnabantur non defendebant. Luther wrote in a polemical and context and delivered, as he said in the address, as soon as he conceived. He was an exegete reflecting the whole of scriptures, not a systematician. For all those reasons, both his person and his work have become the source and wellspring of new insights and inspiration for the generations that followed and will remain so in the future. He paid a price, for no sooner had he closed his eyes in death than friends such as Johann Mathesius, in his biographical sermons published as Dr. Martin Luther's Leben, draped him with hagiographic mistletoe. And enemies such as Johannes Cochlaeus in his De Vita Gestis Martin Luther covered him with poison ivy. Many images of Luther have emerged from the shadows of history and the murky recesses of historians' minds. He has been called a saint and a heresiarch, a mighty oak of Saxony and a reprobate monk, a traveler with a village mentality, a hero and a servile lackey, an iconoclast and an artist, one who drank with students and peasants but dined with princes, a wundermann and a monster, a child of the Middle Ages, the first modern man, prideful and prejudiced, but incredibly sensitive and kind, a proponent of learning but a burner of books, a product of scholasticism and its nemesis, a schismatic and an ecumenist, a homo religiosus and a Renaissance man, a social reactionary and an early bourgeois revolutionary, a liberator and a slave to princes, a humanist and a racist, a rebel and a conservative. He has emerged in the historiography of the past four centuries wearing different masks, such as the, quote, still Catholic Luther, the Lutheran Luther, the Orthodox Luther, the pietist Luther, the enlightened Luther, the idealist Luther, the anthropological realist Luther, the nationalist Luther, and the European Luther, the separatist or the schismatic and the ecumenical Luther. Each image of Luther seems somehow to reflect the perspectives and spirit of the time, but there is a much more positive lesson to be learned from all this than merely that of a sickly historical relativity. namely that it is important to understand the changing images of Luther in our times. For the purpose of historical study is human self-knowledge and understanding of the present that prepares people for the future. From the queries of journalists, the questions of students, the surge of scholarly literature, it seems that three pictures of Luther concern contemporary man more than others, if I'm reading the signs right. One, Marxism view of Luther. Two, Catholicism's image of Luther. And three, Protestant theology's understanding of Luther. Each of these merits a brief but serious examination and will be followed by a mere historian's depiction of, if we dare say it, the real Luther. Presentism, as Jack Hexter has observed, is the historian's leaky boat. So like the Renaissance humanists and Luther himself, he must, for authenticity, go back to the sources and try to get to the historical Luther. One, the Marxist view of Luther. Karl Marx, who died on the 400th anniversary of Luther's birth, had learned something of Luther in his youth when his father, under social pressure, changed to a Protestant church affiliation and had Karl baptized and given catechetical instruction. But Marx was destined to move along with the materialism of his times. A social critic and revolutionary thinker, he rejected religion as the opium of the people. That was 1844, the phrase. The Communist Manifesto of 1848, in turn, has been parodied with these lines. There is a pamphlet filled with blood drawn from the bourgeois veins. Societies plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains. Marx's early criticism of Luther found impassioned expression in his critique of Hegel's philosophy of law. That was 1843 to 44, where he wrote as follows. Germany's revolutionary past is theoretical. It is the Reformation. As then it was the monk, so now it is the philosopher in whose mind the revolution begins. Indeed, Luther was victorious over servitude out of devotion because he put servitude in its place out of conviction. He broke the belief in authority because he restored the authority of belief. He transformed the preachers into laymen, but he transformed the laymen into preachers. He freed men from external religiosity while he placed religiosity into the inner man. He emancipated the body from chains while he laid the heart in chains. Marx's comrade Friedrich Engels, in his tract, The German Peasant War, based upon the highly dubious work of a disillusioned revolutionary named Zimmermann, who in turn based his work on two Anabaptist sources, very unreliable over half a century after the events, made a judgment on the two revolutions, the Reformation and the Peasant Revolt, which proved critical for subsequent Marxist historiography. In an early article on the progress of social reform on the continent, Engels lionized the peasants and played up Thomas Müntzer as the true hero of the Reformation era. The views of Marx coincided precisely with those of Engels. In a famous letter to Ferdinand Lassalle, that's April 19th, 1859, Marx criticized his play on Franz von Sickingen for placing the Lutheran Knights Revolt above the proletariat revolution of the peasants. The old Marx prepared chronological excerpts on German history drawn from Schlosser's 19-volume Weltgeschichte, 1843-56. Making the same judgment on Luther and the Reformation, thus was born the traditional Marxist view of Luther as the social reactionary, the lackey of the princes, and Thomas Müntzer as the true leader and hero of the age, a view that has been dominant in the communist world until very recent times, but is changing. Marx and Luther had some things in common. It's a point we sometimes overlook. A kind of agrarian romanticism, hostility to monopoly capitalism, criticism of usurious interest, a labor theory of value, and utilitarian theory of labor, and the concept of the just price tied in with the preference for the economic autarky of a political state. In Das Kapital and other writings, Marx cited Luther often and with commendation for his, quote, naive rantings, unquote, against usury in his brief and his long sermons on the subject. There were basic differences between the two men, of course, for Luther had an attitude of nonchalance toward economic goods, which are but the poor, he said, breadbasket of our temporal life. He could say, quote, I take in 200 florins a year, but pay out 500. How long can this go on? As Katie wondered that, too, and still never doubted that God would make up the difference. Mein Handel ist kein Mithandel, he exclaimed. He was not a materialist. Almost by anticipation, in fact, Mark Edwards and I disagreed that Luther is the only Lutheran scholar I know who never accepted royalties on his books. I know some who've never gotten royalties. You'll find those names in my footnotes. Almost by anticipation, Melanchthon gave some vindication to the Marxist critique of the Reformation. Melanchthon, when he observed, if it had not been for Luther, longa graviore tumultus would have occurred. Tumults more serious by far. In recent years, a new image of Luther has appeared in the communist world, and especially in the German Democratic Republic. And those of you who were in Erfurt for the big festival in August had a chance to test this out when the minister, the Secretary of State, Giese, talked with representatives of the Congress and of the church and so forth. Something is happening. Luther appears now as the authentic leader of the Reformation, even though the place of the Reformation as an early bourgeois revolution continues to be considered more significant than its religious character. It's to be expected. Luther is no longer a Fürstenknecht, servant of princes, and Münzer is taken for the religious enthusiast he really was. The East Germans even refer to the Münzer Monument, you know, as an elephant toilet stool. It is a mistake to see this new image of Luther merely as a cynical political maneuver designed to win Western currency from tourists. That the Honecker Luther differs substantially from the Ulbricht Luther is the result of much honest historical research and rethinking on the part of East German historians, and a new respect on the part of secular historians for the outstanding East German church historians whose patience and persistence have produced good results. Also somewhat due to a dialogue with Western historians that has gone on for almost two decades. The present view seems to be compatible with a pre-Ulbricht position. For in the Tägliche Rundschau, a paper for the German people, sponsored by the Soviet military administration, an article appeared on February 19, 1946, entitled Luther, the German Fighter on the Eve of Modernity. Giving an interesting picture of Luther, it depicted Luther as the great teacher of the Protestant Church, a living fighter and archetype of German character and culture, alive in the hearts of a broad segment of the German people. He was progressive because he was tirelessly concerned with social relations, and one who argued that the merchant could charge only the just price and no more. Because he argued for the dignity of labor, and because he worked for the unity of the German people, the SED in East Germany has forgotten that little line, but it was published under Soviet auspices. And so, even those who cannot follow him entirely, or not at all in his religious faith, concede that Luther was a great, honorable man, oriented toward this life in the real world, and so forth. From 1946 then to 1984, the Marxist image of Luther has gone through major changes, especially in recent years, and the end is not yet in sight. Luther has not been set forever in ideological cement. He could himself be both subservient and revolutionary. In the words of the English Catholic historian Lord Acton, Luther at Worms is the most pregnant fact in our history. The great fact that we have to recognize is that with all the intensity of his passion for authority, he did more than any single man to make modern history the development of revolution. Nor did Luther fear for the future, for God led him forward like a horse wearing blinders, he wrote, so that he could not see what was coming up against him. We do everything out of ignorance, he wrote, not out of wisdom and precaution. That was not ignorance as to what was involved in any given decisions, but ignorance as to what the end result would be. To Timothy Erasmus in the De Servo Arbitrio, Luther wrote, citing 2 Corinthians 16, let us prove ourselves in tumults. To wish to silence these tumults is nothing else than to wish to hinder the word of God and to take it out of the way. For the word of God, whenever it comes, comes to change and renew the world. You do not see that these tumults and dangers increase through the world according to the counsel and operations of God. And therefore you fear that the heavens may fall about our ears. But I, by the grace of God, see these things clearly, because I see the other tumults greater than these, which will arise in ages to come, in comparison with which these appear to be nothing but the whispering of a breath of air and a murmuring of a gentle brook. I think this is what Reinhold Niebuhr calls Christian nonchalance. 2. Catholicism's image of Luther. Luther's image in the old Catholic historical tradition was, of course, as you know, badly tarnished. Much of it borrowed from Cochlaeus's De Vita, and much of it, there's a three-volume work showing how much of it, through the last four centuries, repeated and repeated some of Cochlaeus's slanders. You know that Luther called him Kutzleffel or Rutzleffel for the Latin Cochlaeus. There was not much mutual affection there. In fact, Luther treated him with great disdain, saying he's not even worthy of a reply, which is the ultimate insult. The polemics of the time were rough, and Luther was the most successful publicist of the age. In 1520, he wrote that he was naturally choleric and did not have a blunt pen. I am, he wrote, therefore carried beyond the bonds of moderation by these monsters. Sylvester Prierius, the Pope's theologian, wrote in the document accompanying the August 1518 summons to Rome on the errors and arguments of Martin Luther, enumerated, exposed, repelled, and fully ground to pieces, in which he described Luther as, quote, a leper and a loathsome fellow, a false libeler and calumniator, a dog and a son of a bitch, born to bite and snap at the sky with his doggish mouth, having a brain of brass and a nose of iron. Prierius argued that the decretals of the Roman Church must be added to the Scriptures as a source of doctrine. The polemics of Prierius were very effective. They won a great deal of sympathy for Luther among the intellectuals and turned Luther very sour on the Roman authorities. Now, this image of Luther as the demonic arch-heresiarch persisted into the 20th century. Father Heinrich de Niefle, in his Luther and Luthertum, 1904, made 3 points. 1, that Luther had broken his monastic vows. 2, that at least 65 instances can be found of interpretations of Romans 1:17 in Luther's sense before Luther's time, thus denying his originality. And 3, that in 1515, the turning point for Luther was the turning point for Luther because this is when his lust finally overpowered him. Didn't get married for another 10 years, you know, but he was overpowered. It is useful to recall the tone of de Niefle's polemic. Luther's melancholy interior, wrote to Niefle, is the midpoint of his theology. Luther gave the impression of being a man who hurls himself into the flood without knowing what he is doing. He believed thereby to have found the best means with which he to make himself the leader of a movement. Now he first sees what he has begun. He cannot turn back. The waves have been set free. His pride does not allow him to rescue himself from it, and so he becomes completely radical. Now Niefle begins warming up to his subject. Luther's understanding was Faustian, the black magic artist. Dr. Faust is only an idealized Luther. The devil controlled him. I think we've been that route before at this conference. The devil who bothers Luther so terribly is Luther's own uneasy conscience. And this devil plagues him more and more. The devil made him do that. The Reformation was the Cloaca Maxima, the large drainage canal. I had a student once who thought Cloaca Maxima was the Empress of Rome. The large drainage canal through which the debris which had long been piling up was conducted away, which would otherwise have ruined and poisoned everything if it had remained in the church. It's not exactly a flattering picture of Protestantism. Another example of the old Catholic image of Luther was that of the Jesuit Hartmann Grisar, whose book in English, by the way, was placed nearly all public libraries by the Knights of Columbus. They were busier than the Gideons, I think. Grisar not only depicted Luther as a manic depressive, but misrepresented his teaching on central doctrines. Quote, the actual point of departure for Luther's teaching, he wrote, was his overweening opinion of himself. His intellectual pride was his actual misfortune. Father Sartori speaks of all this as the pansexual interpretation of Niefle and the pathological interpretation of Grisar. Of course, Luther had detractors other than Roman Catholics. The Anglo-Catholic Hurrell Froude, for example, felt that the best thing that could be said of the Reformers is that they burned well. The gloomy Dean Inge called Luther that vulgar disruptor of Christianity, a merry monster who ate food on fast days, kissed his nun wife, berated the Pope, and utterly rejected philosophy. We need to remind ourselves of the tone of the polemics in those pre-ecumenical days when Luther was satanic and the Pope was the Antichrist and Rome the whore of Babylon. In order to appreciate the achievements of Father Josef Lortz, who began the rehabilitation of Luther during the 1930s and developed a school of revisionists which reversed the tradition of nearly four centuries of vilification. Jerome and Augustine, as you know, found heretics often to be outstanding men. Professor Lortz discovered Luther to be a deeply religious man of sound character who had been an all-too-good monk. He prophesied in the presence of Cardinal Ottaviani in Milan, that is Lortz, that the church someday would make Luther a saint. I told him, I don't think Luther would accept. Lortz was understandably not without reservations and raised the question of Luther's freedom of conscience and the teaching office of the church. Lortz was concerned about the right of theological liberalism in the later or 19th century tradition to appeal to Luther. He also criticized Luther's subjectivity, as he put it, thought that he was nicht vollherrend, didn't hear the whole counsel of God, felt that schism is an essential feature of Protestantism, and declared the problem of authority to be the Achilles heel of Protestantism. Since then, the Lortz, Schule, and many ecumenical Catholic scholars, such as Erwin Iserlohr, Peter Mons, Jared Wicks, Daniel Olivier, the student of Yves Congar, Otto Pesch, Harry McSorley, and many others have explored Luther's theology and found the basically Catholic elements in his evangelical theology. We have in discussions, studies of such major issues as justification, sacrifice in the Eucharist, the nature of the church, scholastic theology, ontology, or even existentialism in Brandenburg's work. These studies by Catholic Luther scholars have become basic for contemporary ecumenical discussions. One cannot imagine the achievement of the current Lutheran Catholic Committee on Doctrinal Unity arriving at a verbal agreement on justification by faith without the preliminary work not only of systematic theologians, but of those church historians who had refurbished Luther's image and had studied Luther's relation to Catholicism in the 16th century world. The discussions will now move on to questions concerning invocation of the saints, the sacraments, and other topics familiar to scholars of the Reformation. That is when the little article on justification will, you might say, hit the fan, because if the Catholic Church really accepts it in the way in which Luther taught it, then many, many things will have to go. Many of the same things that Luther felt should go. On the other hand, maybe Protestantism will be weaned away from a kind of vapid moralism that dominates most pulpits these days. Roman Catholicism has then moved far from Vatican I, far from Pius X's assault on modernism in 1907, to John XXIII and Vatican II, to John Paul II's letter of October 31st of this year, to Johannes Cardinal Willebrand, in which he takes note of the 500th anniversary of Luther's birth. That text is very well worth examination. The Pope not only referred to Luther as, quote, the theologian who contributed in a substantial way to the radical change in the ecclesiastical and secular reality in the West, but he called for a continued historical research, quote, that does not take sides, motivated only by the search for truth, to provide, quote, a true image, unquote, of Luther and the Reformation. The end of these developments is not yet in sight. 3. Protestant theology's understanding of Luther. The Catholic apologist Joseph de Maistre once wrote to Comte de Bray, "I have a great many friends among the Protestants, and now that their system is crumbling, they become more dear to me." In the 19th century, there was indeed some reason to believe that the influence of Luther's theology had at last run its course. It seemed to some that with Ludwig Feuerbach's The Essence of Christianity, 1841, and The Essence of Faith According to Luther, 1844, Protestant theology had finally gone totally bankrupt. In the course of the century, only two comprehensive works on Luther's theology were published, that by Theodosius Hornock, father of the more famous Otto, and by Ignaz Dellinger, an Altkatholiker. But in the 20th century, Luther's image once again has revived, and his theology has become a formative influence on Protestant thought. There are many affinities between the 16th and the 20th centuries, with their wars and catastrophes, political changes, social pressures, individual and collective fears and anxieties. So Luther has risen from the shrouds of the past once again to play a vital role in new developments in theology. Not that Luther had ever been forgotten any more than Shakespeare needed to be revived, which was an old romantic myth. Nonetheless, the strength of his person and the central concerns of his theology seem once again to be especially relevant to the basic needs of theology in our upset times. In a perceptive book on recent developments in German Protestantism, Otto Pieper described the two new trends as the one conservative trend represented by Karl Hull and the Erlangen Lutheran School, and the two progressive trend represented by the neo-orthodox and existential theologians, Karl Barth, Tillich, Wendlandt, the social ethics man and like. The image and central role of Luther in the thought of historians such as Karl Hull and theologians such as Werner Ehlert, Walter von Leeuwenhoek, Wilhelm Maurer, it's fairly obvious. The Luther Renaissance was sparked by the celebration of the 400th anniversary of Luther's birth. the publication of the Weimar edition of his works, which has taken scholars three times as many decades to edit as it took Luther to write them. And the work of the followers of Hull. As that revival of interest in Luther progressed, he and his Theologia Crucis et Passionis, which emerged clearly in his 1516 letters, his sermons, prior and lectures prior to his 1517 thesis, became increasingly an adjunct to systematic theology. At the first International Luther Congress in Aarhus, as has been frequently noted, in 1956, the late Heidelberg professor Heinrich Bornkamm cautioned scholars against the almost positivistic preoccupation with every detail in Luther's theology to the point of forgetting the man himself. Now, a century after Julius Kestlin's basic biography of Luther, 1883, we have in hand an array of splendid biographies. Pictures of Luther the man, although a truly comprehensive account of his last years, still remains to be written. The progressive trend and its relation to Luther is a more subtle matter, requiring closer analysis. The existentialists claim Luther as the one person on the threshold of modernity who moved the search for authenticity, you might say, out of committee and away from the ontological metaphysics into the confines of the individual mind and experience. It will be helpful at the outset of this little discussion to specify those elements in existentialism that are of central importance to its proponents and have held the most meaning for neo-Orthodox theologians. The first of these elements is, of course, giving priority to existence over essence. There is no essence prior to human consciousness. The second is the freedom to make choices. Elego ergo sum. I choose, therefore I am, replaces the cogito ergo sum of Descartes, or the pseudo ergo sum. I sweat, therefore I am, although that is not the word that he used, of Aldous Huxley. The third is the high anxiety resulting from freedom of choice. For facing an undetermined future, man becomes anxious because he is responsible but cannot know the consequences of his decisions. Fourth, the source of value and authenticity of man is subjective, lying within man. Fifth, there is a stress on the need for human solidarity, if I may use that word. We're all on planet Earth together for this brief span of time. Certain elements in Luther's theology lend themselves to an existential approach to theology, and it may be useful by way of a reminder, though you know all these things well, to spell them out. As Wilhelm Pauk, beloved Wilhelm Pauk, was fond of saying, one can learn from Luther a certain way of thinking theologically rather than a system of theological thinking. His theology of the cross is not so much an exposition of truth as a proportion of truth, a series of stresses and emphases, so that it is more like the key signature at the side of a piece of music rather than a set of notes in the score. But it is an all-important proportion, for it focuses revelation and redemption and the whole nature of the Christian life. Many learned volumes have been written on various dimensions of Luther's theology relevant to this progressive trend. But for our purposes, we may stress certain facets most important for the new image of Luther as a theologian. The first of these is his linkage of cognitio Dei et hominis. Now, Zwingli and Calvin did this too. And Calvin has a long and wonderful discussion of this linkage. But it is not so intense and not so central as it is in the case of Luther. The knowledge of God and of man. As in his commentary on Galatians 4, which Luther talks in this way, the duplex est cognitio Dei, the double knowledge of God, knowing God as he reveals himself in and through the man and to men. Or in his well-known description of the subject of theology in his Enarratio of Psalm 51 in 1530. in which he writes Cognitio Dei et hominis est sapientia divina et propria theologica. It is God who justifies, and man the sinner who is made righteous. No one has written more profoundly on this subject than Gerhard Ebeling, who has been involved with the question ever since he undertook many years ago to do his Evangelische Evangelien Auslegung. And I recommend to you his two volumes of Lutherstudien, which come to this question very profoundly, I believe. The second is the emphasis on the discontinuity between man and his original good nature due to the fall. The third is the problematical character of ontology in Luther's theology, resulting from his radical break with scholasticism. In other words, did he shift from sapiential to existential thinking, as the phrase goes? The fourth is the stress upon the abscondite nature of God, the Deus absconditus, as in Isaiah 45:15 in the Vulgate, Vera tu es Deus absconditus. Moreover, the absurdity of life from the creature's perspective did not escape Luther's attention. These are the major facets of Luther's theology which loom large in thinking of his theology in existential terms. There is a subset of emphases, virtually as important for understanding the strange dynamic concreteness of Luther's theology. His writings are replete with expressions such as Wer glaubt, der hat, tantum habes quantum credes, sic ut credat, sic habet, solia ex sola experientia facit theologum, as a man believes he has, experiences make the theologian. If you do not understand, he wrote, that your cause is occurring, the knowledge of all this history is in vain. Among these realistic elements in Luther's theological anthropology, we may note first his stress on the whole man, totus homo, in contrast to the dichotomy and trichotomy of medieval and Renaissance Platonism, reflected in the writings of people also like Erasmus, who was no great Platonist. In my temerity, I do not distinguish body, soul, and spirit, Luther wrote, but present the whole man unto God. Secondly, Luther emphasized the I-thou relationship, which is familiar to all of you boober scholars, commenting that the most important words in religion are the personal pronouns, the I and the thou, Lord, and the he, my brother. Thirdly, Luther's unblinking realism about the certainty and universality of death, that is, life is a living toward death. I recommend to you, if you haven't read the Invocavit sermons, to go over them closely with this in mind, where he talks about life as a besieged city, where sin, death, and the devil are creeping toward slowly but surely toward the city. We each have a place on the wall to defend, and I cannot stand where you stand, you cannot stand where I stand, but nothing prevents us from whispering encouragement to one another. They're very powerful sermons, and they face this business of death straight on. Fourthly, it's Luther's stress on the immanence of God. How comforting was Ficino's God, like the deist God, so far removed, no questions asked. Now, the Greeks have been called the spoiled darlings of the historians, but the Hebrew input into our religious culture has and is much more important. Luther understood that point very clearly. God is immanent. When he speaks, he rumbles and thunders. There's nothing so large but God is larger, nothing so small but God is smaller. He takes over that mystic terminology. God is within us, but does not work without us. In him we live and move and have our being, he cites again and again. Finally, there is Luther's stress upon the priority of experience to being and of being to thought and action, and that comes up already in one of his corollaries in his commentary on Romans. This was an insight that Luther first expressed in that 1515-16 period, but develops and develops throughout his later years. The miracles of my teaching are experiences, he wrote in 1530, and I prefer them to proofs like the resurrection of the dead. These experiences are more certain than life itself, nor are they a false sign to me, but worth many thousands of miracles, since all of the scriptures is filled with such experiences. You have then two witnesses, which are trustworthy and invincible. The scriptures, which tell about the experiences of Israel and many saints, and conscience. Conscience is also an experience. Now, these existential elements in Luther's theology have been explored in many, many books. I offer you one reflection of Luther's image in the mirror of existential theology, one very close to the Rudolf Bultmann school of existential exegesis, if I may use that term. It may not be the best expression, but I think it is representative. It is that of Friedrich Gogarten, who wrote, "Luther broke the supremacy of the ethical over faith down to the very roots. In that he took faith out of the ethical, yes, out of the worldly realm altogether. In faith, through the God who approaches him, man is preserved in his humanity and so is established as person. The work of Christ consists in this, that the possibility of faith is disclosed to man. Christ's humanity is the presentation and the revelation." In 1940, Leonard Pienaar published a very precocious book. It was a study of the existential character of the theology of Luther, pointing to the generic relation between a theology of Anfechtung and Luther's religious solutions. This was a precocious book pointing to a deep vein of thought which I think has still not been fully mined, or on the other hand, undermined. Always reminded of that story Robert Mackey Brown loves to tell about Paul Tillich lecturing on this very point. And he liked to cite Luther also. On one great occasion at Union Seminary, David Lotz must have heard this story often, Tillich said, "What child has not asked, why am I part of the totality of being?" Well, so that's no kid of mine as far as I know. Some intellectual historians have pointed to a concatenation of influences, a linkage of minds running in two directions. One runs from Luther to Kierkegaard to atheistic existentialism, Heidegger to Sartre to Camus. Another runs from Luther to Kierkegaard to theistic existentialism to Jaspers, Bultmann, Gogarten, and their epigony. Kierkegaard really knew very few of Luther's writings, it seems, and he understood mostly only the dark and threatening side of Luther in the scriptures and what he picked up from the Lutheranism of his day. Still, he did develop in the Lutheran culture, and he caught some glimpses of Luther's deep insights into theology, that is to say, of reality. In contrast to the prevailing idealist philosophy of Hegel or the materialism of Feuerbach, whom Kierkegaard called a malicious demon, though a capable person. I have to remember that for my next book review. Allow me to offer a few examples of a certain consanguinity between Kierkegaard and Luther. In the concluding unscientific postscript, Kierkegaard indulged in a typical bit of Lutheran irony on the limitations of worldly culture. And this is the kind of quotation that you really like to roll over your tongue and cherish. "The absolute paradox," he wrote, "will maintain itself well enough, for in relation to the absolute, more intellect gets one no further than less intellect. On the contrary, they get equally far. Let others extol culture unreservedly. Let it then be extolled. But I would rather extol it because it makes it so difficult to become a Christian. For I am a friend of difficulties, especially of such as possess the humoristic quality that the most cultured person, after having endured the greatest exertions, has gotten no farther than the simplest man can get. Or again, another quotation from Kierkegaard on stark reality and the priority of individuals' existence. Quote, two ways in general are open for an existing individual. Either he can do his utmost to forget that he is an existing individual, by which he becomes a comic figure. Since existence has a remarkable trait of compelling an existing individual to exist whether he so wills or not. Or he can concentrate his entire energy on the fact that he is an existing individual. It is from this side in the first instance that objection must be made to modern philosophy. Not that it has a mistaken presupposition, but that it has a comical presupposition, occasioned by its having forgotten in the sort of world historical absent-mindedness what it means to be a human being. Not indeed what it means to be a human being in general. For this is the sort of thing that one might even induce a speculative philosopher to agree to. But what it means that you and I and he are human beings, each one for himself. I sometimes think of Kierkegaard against Hegel as Luther against Scholasticism. Now, when Luther says Thomas has been seduced by metaphysics, therefore he is so loquacious. 21 volumes in the Summa. No. Of course, there are 110 volumes in Luther's works. Kierkegaard also knew, like Luther, the necessity for each person to believe for himself. In his Confession of Faith, he wrote, if a man is to be a Christian, it is doubtless requisite for him to believe something definite. But it is just as certainly requisite for him to be quite definite that he believes. In the same degree that thou dost direct attention exclusively to the definite things a man must believe, in that same degree you get away from faith. You are all familiar with his feelings about the concept of dread, his fear and trembling. The use of paradox, which is almost, in his case, pathological, but it is reminiscent of Luther's Dennoch, where the scholastics add everything up and conclude ergo. Luther said things do not add up. Dennoch, nevertheless, I believe. The contemporaneousness of the contemporary, and other such phrases that really have a Luther overtone. The roof of the world has blown off and we again look up into gray infinity. You're all familiar with the Buber and Boltzmann and the invasion of biblical exegesis by existentialism, the reduction of revelation to an ahistorical kind of kerygma. This total development owes much to Luther, it is true, but it offers a false image of the whole and the wholesome Luther. Katie Luther was not Regina Olsen. Luther was so much more than Kierkegaard. In many ways, Grundtvig, as Professor Grana loves to point out, was more like Luther than was Kierkegaard. There can be no doubt but that neo-orthodoxy has enabled Protestant theologians of our day to see Luther more clearly as he really was. One of the finest statements comes from the pen of Karl Barth, who was essentially Calvinist, as you know, more Reformed than Lutheran, but in the Göttingen period he did lecture on Luther and learned a good deal about him and from him. In one of his most striking books, a pamphlet for our times, Karl Barth wrote, "Der Götze of Occult, the idol of modernity, is tottering," published Berlin 61. He wrote of Reformation as decision, Reformation als Entscheidung, elego ergo sum. And he came in the course of that book to speak about Luther and the Reformation in words that I think show how this neo-Orthodox approach to theology has opened eyes again and gotten people in a position where they can begin to understand Luther better than he was understood, I think, throughout the 19th century. Karl Barth writes, translate it for your listening pleasure. At no time in the past four centuries has the evangelical church ceased to be concerned with the Reformation, even in periods when it was not congenial to the pervading spirit. Orthodox, pietist, enlightenment, idealist, romantic, positivist. Some say it is the cultural, political, or national content of the Reformation which gives it its special, memorable character. That's the German Luther you recognize. Some say it is the heroic and creative personalities who made the Reformation, Thomas Carlyle, says Barth. Still, those reformers were not essentially poets, philosophers, or kings. Some say it is the breakthrough of the powers of inwardness as the period for probing the deep and immediate meaning of the deepest grounds of human existence as a living religion. Only a German could write a sentence like that. One came much closer to the truth when, in earlier centuries, one saw the service and greatness of the reformers in this, that the reformers once again declared Christian truths that were either forgotten or half forgotten in the church. The glory and authority of the Bible, the sovereignty of God the Creator, the meaning of Jesus Christ as the Savior of sinful man, the power of faith in this Jesus, the freedom of the Christian in the world, the necessary humility and the necessary courage of the true church. There's no mystery if you ask the reformers about the meaning of their movement. They will assert that it has to do with the pure teaching of these truths, and with this pure teaching has to do with right obedience, right life, right form of the church, or negatively, for the freeing from the papacy as a form of church worship, church law, and church morality, which did not agree with this pure teaching. That's true. My father had a colleague in his circuit in Nebraska who stuttered. This poor pastor stuttered, and he would say, the Catholic ickies, that they are not the right Christian Christians, and the Methodist and Isten, they are not the right Christian Christians, but we Lutherans, we are the right Orthodox and oxen, and so on. There has in recent years been a movement in theology beyond the reductionism of existential theology. And as the reformer type or Luther type, I can only greet this movement beyond existentialism toward a sounder, a more whole, a full scriptural kind of theology. Like, I just came from Wittenberg University, and one of the little undergrads held up her hand and she said, did you know that Jesus never lived? And I said, no, I didn't know that. And she said, well, that's what my religion teacher said, but he said it's okay as long as we've got the kerygma. She said, what was that? Kerygma, she said. Then it doesn't matter. And so, well, a better knowledge of Luther on the part of that religion professor would have made it easier to take into account the whole counsel of God. I think that the way to understand Luther is partly the way Karl Hall understood him, as patterning himself on St. Paul. Partly, and I think this is even better, is Erwin Mühlhaupt seeing Luther as one who patterns himself on Christ. But in the Erfurt meetings, I suggested at all too great length and in German that the way in which Luther thought of himself most consistently the image that he had of himself was that of a pastor and of a doctor of theology, a doctor of the church. And his oath that he took as a doctor of the Bible in 1512, he said, meant more to him than any other oath that he took except the baptismal vow as a child. I have often said, and I still say, he wrote, I would not exchange my doctor's degree for all the world's gold. God and the whole world bear testimony that I entered into this work publicly and by virtue of my office as a teacher and preacher, and have carried it hitherto by the grace of God. It was as a pastor, an ecclesiast, a minister verbi divini, is the phrase that he uses again and again, that he acted, and he calls himself consistently, because when he was stripped of his titles, the title of being an ecclesiast, and a pastor, now Luther deliberately for a number of years calls himself always, comma, ecclesiast, henceforth. It's sort of interesting to see how that word pastor tended to emerge in the Protestant tradition over pfaff or priest and all. The term pastor and shepherd did not really come into general use until the 18th century, but it's interesting to note that Luther, patterning himself after Christ, used it consistently, pastor, shepherd, and so forth. The Reformers talked about the Prediger and the Predikamt and the Predikant, and they retained the medieval term pfarrer, parson, but it's related to the word parochus, pastor, parson, parochia, parish, and all. But it's funny to see that the common people stuck with the pfaff and the priest, and in many areas of Germany still do. As Scott Hendricks has pointed out in his wonderful book on Luther and the papacy, Luther was a pastor to Christendom, and he shouldered that burden only because the Bishop of Rome and all too many other bishops had betrayed their calling and were not shepherds to Christ's sheep and lambs. He felt called upon to act because these Renaissance popes had defaulted. Now, we often think of Luther as professor, as the thesis writer, you know, whether he nailed them to the door or not. Anyway, no one knows whether he was trying to get in or out when he was banging. It is in an address of this brevity possible. It's just not possible to document this whole thesis or to give you that whole one-hour lecture again. So we'll move to a conclusion on that point by reading a quotation or two from Luther that illustrate his self-image as a professor and pastor. He also had the idea that he was a prophet. And Mark Edwards has pointed this out to me, that Luther becomes increasingly sure of himself as a prophet as part of his calling. And the more opposition that he ran into, the more firmly he was convinced that he was suffering like those Hebrew prophets whom Luther said, I will always try to speak better German. Make them speak better German. Well, was Luther the kind of pastor that he describes in his writings? Who could live up to the ideal that he set for himself? When he spoke about model pastors, he used these attributes. He's prayerful, he's studious, he's diligent, industrious, blameless, sound in doctrine, faithful, selfless, serving, courageous, substantive, patient, humble, religious, spiritual, not self-seeking, loving, devout, willing to take abuse, willing to serve Christ and his people, and so forth and so on. Clearly, Luther was not that kind of preacher. If I wanted to write about the burdens of a minister as I know and have experienced them, he said, I would frighten all away from the office. For a good minister must hazard everything, so that nothing is dearer to him than Christ and eternal life. And that after he has lost this life and everything, Christ may say, "Come to me, my son." I hope that he will speak to me this way, too, on the last day. For here he speaks very unkindly to me. I am burdened with the entire world, with the emperor and the pope, and I have to stand there and say it's okay. After that, the devil also talks to me, and he would often have destroyed me with this argument, "You are not called." But then I show him my doctor's ring and I say, "I have been called as a doctor of the church, and I shall continue to teach and preach until the last day, even though I would so gladly give it up." When it comes to theology, Luther wrote, "Es gehört eine gewisse Bescheidenheit dazu." A lot of modesty is called for. Luther would have been embarrassed to be fated as we're doing today. To his enemies, he said, "Rest assured that you shall neither destroy my name nor my doctrine." Yet, in his treatise on the partaking of both elements in the sacrament, Luther wrote, "You must not be Luther's, but you must be Christ's disciples." Sort of a Gotteswort und Luther's Lehre für gehen neu nimmer mehr kind of treatment. I beg you not to call yourself Lutherans, but Christians, he wrote in 1522. What is Luther? The teaching is not mine. I was not crucified for anyone. How then should I, a poor stinking bag of maggots, live to see the day when they label the children of Christ, who alone is our master, with my wicked name? I am master of none. I trust only the common, the simple, the fine, sound teachings of Christ, who alone is our master. Luther's last words offer an assessment of himself, you know, his famous deathbed words. Wir sind Bettler, huc est verum, we are beggars, and that's the truth. Now, when Melanchthon heard of Luther's death, he wept. Men wept quite openly in the 16th century, you know. They just stopped doing that in the 18th and early 19th, that stiff upper lip business. When Melanchthon heard of Luther's death, he wept, and then he pulled himself together and he announced to the students the passing of Luther with these words, "Alas, gone is the horseman. Gone are the chariots of Israel." He delivered one of two magnificent funeral orations over Luther. If you've never read Melanchthon's funeral oration, I recommend it to you as a really wonderful nugget. It is a reformer's insight into the course of church history. He places him in line with the prophets, the evangelists, the apostles, but this is especially interesting, the great churchmen of the medieval period. This angel said, "Fear God and give him glory." Those are the two parts of Dr. Martin Luther's teaching, the law and the gospel, through which all of scriptures are opened up and Christ is known as our righteousness and eternal life.
Thank you very much, Professor Spitz.